My name's Jack Underwood.
And my name's Rachel Allen.
And you're listening to the Faber Poetry Podcast.
Hi, my name is Matthew Rohr, and I'm reading you a poem from my new book, Army of Giants, published by Wave Books this year. I'm in my office in Greenwich Village, and this is a poem called Yevtushenko Was the King. This poem ends with a line that is the same line that ends Yevtushenko's amazing poem, Zima Junction. Yevtushenko was the king. When the drunk Russian on the F train pulled out his flask, people moved to other seats, but not me. He said, "You're reading Yevtushenko in English." I was. He told me his father, in the thaw of which Yevtushenko was the king, wore jeans with battery-powered Christmas lights up and down the legs. "Do you have to go?" he said. I had gathered my things. We were at my stop. "I would like to hear him in English." I said, "I'm sorry. I have to go." And I went. And I'm still going.
That was an audio postcard from Matthew Rohr. His collection, Army of Giants, is out now with Wave. Rachel, who do we have in the studio with us today?
Isabel Baffy, who is the reviews editor at Poetry London. Her pamphlet, Ripe, published by Ignition Press in 2020, won a Somerset Maugham Award and was the Poetry Book Society pamphlet choice. Her debut collection, Chaotic Good, will be published by Faber & Faber and Wesleyan University Press in 2025.
And joining Isabel today, we have Sarah Howe. Sarah is a Hong Kong-born poet, academic and editor. Her first book, Loop of Jade, Chateau Mundus, 2015, won the T.S. Eliot Prize and the Sunday Times Young Writer of the Year Award. A new collection is forthcoming in 2025. Previous honours include the Hawthornden Fellowship and the Harperwood Studentship for English Poetry, as well as fellowships from Harvard University's Radcliffe Institute and Civitella Ranieri Foundation. Quite all right there, didn't I? Not too bad. She is the poetry editor at Chateau and Windus. Welcome to you both.
And we'll start maybe with a reading from you, Sarah,
yeah.
If that sounds good.
Yeah, I might read a teeny one and then a slightly longer one.
Fab.
Sort of knit a little bit. These are brand new poems. I'm test driving these on you guys.
Well, I don't mean to say, Sarah, I know you have been busy, but I was looking at that Loop of Jade 2015.
It has been a little while.
Even longer than I take to write a bit.
It is not the optimal rate of production, it has to be said.
Hey, it's nice to be butting against the horrendous productivity narratives of late capitalism in our art form.
Yeah.
And you are shining rebel star in that regard. But let's hear some new work. I'm so excited.
Okay. Tell all the truth, but when my next slide clicks into place, tell it slant. It sets off an involuntary ricochet inside my head. Slant eyes, slant rhymes, slant. Still I shan't tell about those playground jibes, jingles, fingers stretched to press lids taut, save how it taught me, still now, to press a lid, tell it slant, on anything like rage. Throwback. Early on, I wonder at our daughter, how my strong genes could birth one so improbably fair. I whisper, "My chick," to her cradle-capped wisps, now almost see-through, husband joking, "Is she really mine?" This all seems mostly a laugh, till one day a relative points out the baby looks more Chinese than her brother. Innocently meant, it's something around the eyes. Later, I scrutinize the flaky moon of her face imprinted on those otherworldly nights, trace epicanthic folds more marked than mine in her shuffled deck of eclectic traits. This personal Babel, chromosomal riddle of crumbs leading back through God knows what ancestral dark. As she snuffs, draws her taut bow into my chest, eyes and fists tight. And yes, when I had seen out half a race of zodiac beasts and landed on Earth's other face, I began to dream of hair this shade, rubbed roiling clouds of talc into my cheeks. That day an English girl, mid ring-a-ring, recoiled from the invisible yellow stain my gripped palm left on hers, asking the mirror for the difference.
Hmm. It's so lovely to hear your voice again, Sarah, and in the poems coming through, and the sort of careful way that you that your poems seem to sort of build out of themselves. They start with quite sort of you know, unassuming doorways sometimes, and then they lead to a corridor and another corridor. I think there was that fabulous poem in the Poetry Review, which was the most recent thing of yours I've read before today, about the laundry.
It has a really long title, so everyone sort of comes up to me and says, I liked your laundry poem.
Yeah, that's right. which is kind of like this sprawling, narrative, surreal poem. These feel more sort of careful and... not that that's not careful, you know what I mean? These feel more sort of like positioned and... Yeah. Tell us a bit about how you sort of feel like you're writing, the places you're writing from at the moment, and if you feel like there's been any sort of preoccupations or shifts in style since Loop of Jade.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, Jack. I mean, I think the difference in feel between that rangy prose poem where every line ends in laundry and these is partly because of the instrument of the line, and that these sort of pick their way down a spiral staircase of very short lines. And I guess that comes of a sort of desire to take things slowly. I definitely had the feeling, that's interesting you say corridors and corridors, when I was writing that poem Throwback, of sort of, I'd write a few stanzas and then it was like, I fell through a trapdoor in the floor and wrote a few more and then fell through another trapdoor. That was the feeling that I had, like I was moving down through successive more and more subterranean spaces of the mind. I feel like maybe that little poem I read at the start is me groping towards some sort of poetics or ars poetica that could explain the difference between myself in my late 20s, early 30s, writing Loop of Jade, and myself around 40, now writing this book. And Tell It Slant is a sort of parable of that, that really does come out of the 7 or so years I spent teaching creative writing in a university and putting that up on the slide for my 7th lecture of term, you know. And I guess I was very struck when I came across it by that quite famous quotation of Winnicott's, you know, where he says something like, it is a joy to be hidden and a disaster not to be found, right? And I feel like Loop of Jade was a very elaborate exercise of camouflage and trying on masks and guises. And I would never assume not to be wearing masks, except that I feel like, why do these poems feel so much more self-exposing in a way when I might expect to have gone in the other direction post that book? But I think the answer is that these poems are trying to be a space in which something more of me can safely appear. Yeah, that's probably the answer. And that there's a politics to that.
Yeah, and a politics of rage in that first,
It's interesting, though, when you talked about the many doorways that the poems seem to open or move through, and then the trap doors that you're falling through. And I was thinking about the vehicle of teaching and the vehicle of a child and the kind of uncanniness that both of those situations throw up for ourselves. When we teach, there's an element of sort of performative mirroring, which also felt like it was coming through in those poems, a kind of interest in how we show ourselves, how we see ourselves, and then explore that. And so the portal of the teaching space, the classroom, the slide, the portal of the child felt to me like quite sort of mystical tangents that you're moving through, very grounded in the real world spaces of being a parent and being a teacher, but utilizing those things to kind of reach through into a space of figuring out the self. And when you said it is a joy to be hidden and a disaster not to be found, I was thinking a bit more about that, the way that these new poems, or at least the ones that we're lucky enough to hear, it feels like disclosure and exposure, that that's being played with in a really kind of interesting way.
How do you feel about that sort of new vulnerability of a kind of more, I suppose, because it's strange, isn't it? It's kind of at once less lyric and more lyric. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I guess in ways that make me uncomfortable, these feel like poems that I would perhaps more logically have written in a first book. It's peculiar to me that. I don't feel totally comfortable with it, but I suppose I've been writing out of a self-protected kind of space where I've been telling myself these poems have no audience beyond me. And I think I have made peace with them going out into the world and doing their work. I somewhat haven't quite unpicked the motivations for why this work, why now, why write about racist aggressions that happened in a playground 35 years ago. I think there are perhaps reasons for that that will become clearer to me in the next few months as this book finds its gravity and its final line. But somehow this is what's been swimming up. I suppose maybe in the way that parenting small children makes one think back to one's own small childhood.
Yeah.
And becoming a parent, becoming a mother, in my case, has made me reappraise my own sense of my mothering, my being mothered. And that's maybe the through line of this book, I think. I thought I'd written enough about my mum. She seems to be coming back with force again. And that's because you re-understand things in a new light when you become a parent. There were various things that clicked into place for me that I suddenly understood about my childhood in late colonial Hong Kong. And the situation of my home life, shall we call it, which was a political situation, a situation in many ways of white supremacist patriarchy. I haven't quite worked myself up to writing that situation yet, but I'm finding slants for it. This is me working up to something, I think.
I like that chromosomal riddle of crumbs and the ancestral dark. And then you said you were interested in these subterranean spaces. And I feel like these poems feel exploratory, even though they're so crystallized and there is this sort of idea of clarity within them. They do feel like they are exploring or perhaps creating a base for that maybe next stage of the poetics to come within that exploration.
Also, I think as you do get a bit older, I think you just give less of a shit, don't you, about what people think.
There is, and
I think there's kind of like, well, the idealization of like achieving something in poems or whatever. I certainly realize that whatever you do, somebody's going to hate it. You know what I mean? Or there's always going to be somebody with something to say, and you can't please everyone. Like, so you may as well who the hell you want to please.
And poetry, it's not inconsequential. It's of the hugest consequence. But it is the space with the least consequence in regards to, like, I don't know, because it's not a self necessarily. That's like the oldest thing. it's not you. That's right. You know, it's a fiction. It's a fictionalized space. It's a space of artifice, and maybe also coming to terms with that at a stage where you feel like, oh, I'm more able to inhabit that artifice, even if it's embodied by experiences that I have been privy to or been alongside or within. It is an artificial space.
Yeah, I guess like when you think of like your various speakers in your poems, and the fact that like it seems almost absurd to be talking about the speaker when you've been publishing poems for like 20 years. Do you know what I mean? But in a way, that's sort of, they're almost more of a, the more poems you write, the more the eye becomes like trumped up, rigged up, could be anyone.
Well, of course. I mean, even just in a sort of psychological sense, unless you're writing and publishing as we speak, it's not what is even an authentic rendering.
Yeah.
And how we play with that memory and how we play with that artificial space is where the interesting work happens for me, alongside a life. I'm doing quotes.
Life in air quotes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm looking at a material object on the table.
Oh my God, yeah, we do talismans, don't we? Fantastic. Yeah, I was wondering what that was.
I wonder.
A part of me thought, it's like, are we just allowed to smoke in here now? And this is just...
It would be a very tasteful, massive ashtray.
Really tasteful ashtray.
My show and tell
it's
proffering.
Huge.
Can you guess what it is? Is it that unfair to put you on the spot?
Well, it's like there's a bowl in a bowl.
It's ceramic.
Yeah, it's a bowl in a bowl. It's a porcelain sort of greenish tinge.
Is that the mould for it?
So this is called a waster.
Yeah.
And I picked this up in a town called Jingdezhen in China, which has been the centre of porcelain production in China for thousands of years. And you walk through the streets and the potters have their studios right on the edge of the pavement. And when things go wrong in the firing process, in the kiln, they just chuck them out the back of the door and you can pick up gems like this. So this is this is a dish that's gone wrong in the firing process. So it's sort of become this hybrid fused creature where the porcelain dish that's sitting inside this shell called a saga, that's the rough earthenware thing that's supposed to protect the delicate ceramic from the heat. They've ended up melting into each other. And so this dish on the top is sort of flawed and cracked and deformed and melted.
Yeah, it's got a sort of, I'd say a sort of poppadom, uncooked poppadom aspect to it. It's beginning to pock there.
So normally you would just lift the beautiful moon-like dish out of that vessel at the end of firing, but now they're irrevocably fused.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
It's amazing, isn't it? And so it's got this armour, like a barnacle now, this plate.
I think it looks like a fried egg on a plate.
Nice.
But I guess I keep this relatively near to my desk, and it feels like a talisman to me in all sorts of ways that I'd probably need psychoanalysis to entirely explain. But there's something about the two faces of it put together, the polished, refined side that's sort of melting, and then this hard, coarse armour, and the way that it's become this new hybrid creature that's a failure that gets chucked out onto the scrap heap, but that is also so beautiful.
Trying so hard not to identify
with this.
This
is so much more fascinating.
But also, I'm just like, free ceramic. That's amazing.
Like, isn't it like, I find a magnetism to this failed, broken thing much more than I think if that dish had come out perfect. I guess kintsugi as a motif has become rather over present in contemporary poetry, but this feels like more meaningful as an emblem of poetics and making and striving through failure and mishap. And
I mean,
and
I would have never thought, because I am like a scourer of ceramics and I'm really into ceramic artists and I buy a lot of ceramics. I was like, oh, it's obviously some ceramic artist who's developed this like way of creating bowls or something. I would have not even had a clue that that was a mistake, you know, or a broken thing or a hybrid thing. To me, it just looks like a piece of ceramic art, which it is, actually.
Yeah,
so
yeah, you just go to Jingdezhen, Rachel, and pick some up.
I would harvest the ceramics.
There's little marks there, isn't there? On the sort of a brushstroke of some kind recorded in it.
Yeah.
Did you pick up many?
It's bubbled. I picked up two.
Yeah.
This is my favourite one, though.
Mm. Lovely. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that I think it's the two surfaces and the
sci-fi kind of.
It's quite suggestive, isn't it? I mean, I can't help but think of going back to that conversation of the lyric, and I'm like, which one is the speaker?
Yeah,
which
one
am I the barnacle?
Feel like, I think you're on the right track. Like, I feel like in that throwback poem, there's the light face of the earth and the dark face of the earth. And I feel like this object is exemplifying that somehow. Mm. That I have certain poems that walk in the light and have this clarity, like you were talking about, like that porcelain. But then there are other poems in this book which work much more like the poem that I might read at the end, which I've been thinking to myself of as undersongs, like the sort of rough material dredged up from the dark unconscious that is not formed in the same way, and that somehow the book is a dialogue of the two, like a fusion of the two.
I'm just going to pass this over to Isabel, who's looking quizzically and...
No, it's beautiful. I was just, as you were talking, I was just thinking, like, you know, obviously there's a beautiful polished interior. And then, as you were saying, the kind of rough, coarse exterior. And but ironically, that's what holds the beautiful thing and keeps it protected, you know, keeps it intact. And as you're saying, the two are definitely in dialogue.
Yeah, if you don't love me at my rough, knotty out exterior, you...
You don't deserve me. Yeah. Polished,
oh, hang on, I've got that the wrong way around, have I? I don't know. Oh, no,
but
that is the right way around.
Because they're both amazing. There's no... To me, they're both... There's no good one.
No.
You know? That's all just in the knowledge of how they are set up to be utilised. It's like function... Like, one is functional and one isn't, technically, but then actually they both are devoid now of their function, so we can just enjoy them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one... And the beautiful one is broken and a failure.
Aren't they always?
I know. I think it's perfect analogy for me and you, Rachel. The,
which one pretend, am I? I'm the fried egg.
Don't pretend you don't know.
Isabel, shall we have you jump in and read a poem?
Yes, let's hear.
Okay. Watermelon. A shapeshifter sleeps in my brother's room. Shape of a boot, then a wolf, then a mangled tree. He had a ball. It changed colour when squeezed. He taught the sun to look away when he went out to hunt. I used to watch him through the bars of the safety gate, cutting watermelons into smiles. I couldn't read, but in the scratches on his back, I saw every girl he'd ever wanted. When he finally let me in, I held the watermelon down so it couldn't roll away. And he gave me the biggest smile of them all, the biggest smile I had ever seen. Path of Least Resilience. I grew up in a trench like this, spring blossom dancing into the arms of wet cement. The city had many afflictions, volcanoes, post-humanism, a cloud that followed everyone who laughed too long, plus the pig at the edge of town, trapped in barbed wire, eaten alive for days. Every friend I ever hated lived there, and the man who made a bouquet of all the syllables of my name. He came in like a cough of pollen, settling on my eyebrows, lodged beneath my fingernails, the way a single sesame seed bursts shoulders into hives. Imagine our life like this, pigeons waving at us through dirty windows, despair nestling between us like a comma. Imagine us against the sound of bed slats breaking, breaking. There is a graze in becoming what you condemned. The friendships sink easily. Every pet inherits the same name. You learn to lower yourself into the tub before the water, run it shame hot to the rim. If you're honest, you'll introduce yourself as the scar of all the possible yous you displaced. You will disdain the cement that hardens your steps. You will injure the feet that carried you. Every morning, we relayed the road to try and correct our mistake. Every pig refused to die until our knives hit bone.
Thank you. I was talking a little bit to you about your book this morning and getting very excited about the sort of strangeness of it and the strange turn of phrase within poems that feel concise and economical and with a narrative at their core, and also within a book that itself has a sustained narrative and is sectioned quite clearly into parts that would follow a life-ish. And I wondered if maybe you wanted to talk a little bit about that structure, because this is something that really interested me as a way into talking more about the poem's minutiae, the strangeness of the language and the kind of upturned phrases and intentional mistakes and weird kind of skewerings of moments of familiarity that made the work feel so familiar but also defamiliarized to me.
Yeah, thank you for that. So I think with the structure, that kind of came during the editing process. When I initially put together the manuscript, it was not as ordered as it was. It wasn't as clear that this was this section of this stage in life, this stage, this stage. And I think because there's so much that happens and so much of it is quite dreamlike, like I write in response to my dreams quite a lot. Watermelon was a dream. And there are elements of so many of the poems which, you know, came from dreams. So I think the ordering was important to kind of demarcate what stage of existence this is kind of relating to and what we're exploring. Each stage has its own complexities, its own questions. With childhood, like, you know, you were, as you were, Sarah was reading in her poems and talking so much, like it's really a time of discovery, the self, seeing oneself in the mother, and in some ways the mother seeing themselves in the child as well. So there's a lot of strangeness in that stage alone, a lot of discovery and things which don't make sense until much later. So the revisitation and the jumping forward and back through time, it kind of lends itself, I think, to that kind of exploration.
Yeah, and just so there's clarity for listeners, it moves separation, childhood, adolescence, marriage, and rebirth. And I found this kind of episodic structure really powerful, actually, that I was able to sort of group the poems in a way. And then I was thinking about reading the poems without those structuring devices. And I just think it's such a brilliant effect that it has on the poems, that we have this kind of arc running through. It threads them together in a way that I feel makes the book, I don't know, a story is created without you impressing a story upon us. And it means that a lot of the poems that have these abstractions or have these dreamlike nebulous qualities, they're then able to be contained within the larger package of the story. Was this something that you intended, to sort of have the story of a thing, of a... I guess there's so many different things, like a coming of age, a relationship breakdown, and everything that happens within those sort of pockets of experience.
So, essentially, yes. Like, initially, the manuscript was completely chronological. So childhood, adolescence, marriage, and then separation. It was just those four. But it wasn't, the sections weren't called that. They were called something very different. And I think when I showed it to editors, they were, you know, they had the impression that it was like looking at, I guess, the formation of identity and coming of age. And then the marriage bit felt a bit kind of tacked on, or like it took it in a very different direction. And maybe it felt like different books to them. So I think through that, I realized that, oh, I need to restructure it and just foreground that this is about a woman walking away from, you know, a toxic, abusive relationship. And using this as an opportunity to reflect on how she had been in some ways primed for that sort of relationship, and how the identity, how the self forms, and yeah, how the world is structured in a way that kind of normalizes certain forms of behavior and certain ways of thinking. Mm. So that structure kind of became quite necessary, I think.
And what's so nice about having a structure that feels so firm is that within that, the poems are able to have the destabilizing effect that you kind of sew into the fabric of the poems. There's a poem that's like entirely made up of kind of misspellings. And I suffer from migraines quite badly. And I was reading the poem and I was sort of coming out of myself as I was reading the poem, going back over each word and the idea of slippage and mistake and correction felt like such a knotty moment within the book that is already about kind of going back over our slippages, our like quote unquote mistakes. Yeah. And I guess I'm interested in the rub between the tension, the friction of the quirkiness, the difficulty, the strangeness in the poem's lexicons and that structure. It feels like they run up against each other like this in a way that was so just pleasing to read.
Oh, thank you. I hope it didn't trigger any migraines.
I always think that I'm having one, so I was like, it's happening.
I love playing with language. I really loved playing with like tenses as well, because so much of what I wanted to do was like think about time and power and free will, and how you make one choice and then it can dictate, you know, so much of the rest of your life or change the course of your life forever. And what does it mean to live with that choice and to want to revisit that choice and change it? But obviously we can't, you can't revisit the past or you can't change the past. So, playing with tenses, playing with time, different types of mirroring and doubling, they were all present because for a long period of my life, I was constantly experiencing multiple versions of my life that didn't exist, and thinking about how to make them possible and who else I could have been. And in some ways, those versions felt like they were coexisting in parallel. So, yeah, thinking about mistakes and errors was all part of it. Moving punctuation around, things like that. It was all, yeah.
And musical things as well. It seems like some of the phrases can only really have come out of kind of like feeling your way through like a cough of pollen. It's a lovely kind of open... that sounds like one of those nice phrases that arrives because the... I don't know, because it sounds good, you know? Mm. And then you're like, oh, this is an interesting... if you trust the music first.
You go and you work out of that sound, you work out of the phrase, you trust the logic of the phrase almost maybe.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like there is, musicality is important to me. Rhythm is important. There's a poem called The Cottage, which is like this like strange scenario thing. And basically I was reading Emily Berry and I was reading Vivi Francis, who are two poets whose work I really love. And their work is so immersive and dreamlike and gothic in certain ways, especially Vivi Francis. And as I was reading, I just kept hearing the word wood, wood, wood. And it was like both W-O-O-D and W-O-U-L-D. Mm. And so I was just thinking about, you know, different forms of like possibility and different time frames. And so then the poem came out of that, thinking about, yeah, being in a wood and thinking about what sounded right. Mm. Yeah.
It's just funny. I feel like there's lots of ambiguity in the poems, which I just love that the kind of, your poems feel like they're being constructed and it's leading something and something's being built. But what it leads to is kind of like still, it's sort of a resonant, absent sort of thing that's not quite said.
I was thinking about Louise Glück, actually, and my favourite line from Louise Glück, which is, "Even now this landscape is assembling," which the poem All Hallows starts with that line, especially in regards to the cottage. The memory built me around it. Mm. This idea of the poem almost beginning in medias res, is that the right term? That's the right term, isn't it? Like it's starting in the middle of itself, or it's a continuation of an occasion, and the poem line is the articulation of that occasion occurring. But we know that the activeness and the activity is still occurring, still being created, still being decided on. Mm. And in that way, there's a kind of really nice ambivalence in the work. It destabilizes you. It says, don't settle.
I think, isn't it funny that that's always like the most, I always find that kind of ambivalence and ambiguity and that little kind of, when you feel like something has been circumlocuted that you can't quite, that you know is there, but what is it? I just, that's such a, like, the most delicious and profound quality of poems. But it's often the one that people are most scared of.
Spooky. It's because it's spooky.
People endlessly talking about whether poems are relatable or accessible, or like whether people, and people worried about whether people will understand them in poems. And nobody nobody ever talks about how awful it is when people can understand them. nobody really talks about like the pleasure in not understanding in that way. And I feel that's probably true of both your poems. I feel they both kind of lead us up the garden path a bit, don't they? In a kind of like, you know, in a very courteous, so I'm tracking this. And then, you know, suddenly find ourselves alone on some poetic, profound, hard shoulder.
Well, the cottage, the cottage feels like such a perfect encapsulation of that, actually. The memory built me around it, an abandoned trail, a forest with no sky. I was both the wood of the axe and the wood of the tree. A cat was dying in my bag. Like, I cannot have read five lines of poetry that is like, A, just amazing, but like more up my street.
Do you know
what I mean? Like, it's just so...
Oh, with the dying cat and everything.
It's strange. It's so strange. And I love just living in that word when I think about the work, actually.
I think about in Inception, where Leonardo DiCaprio's character says, he's explaining dreams and he's like, the mind creates the world and experiences it at the same time. Mm. So as though, you know, you don't know what's going to happen. And so, and he's like, yeah, obviously with the work he does, they try to interrupt that. And yeah, I think I was trying to do something similar.
Mm. Yeah. Dreams have a lot of turns in them. Both your poems have turns. Like we're not waiting for the turn at line 8. We get it usually in about line 3 or something, you know, and then and maybe about five per poem. That's a good reward. I wonder if that's kind of, Sarah, is that something that you kind of, your poems kind of like seem like they're working into an argument and then turn again and kind of chew and...
The word that's coming into my mind as you say that, Jack, is a swerve. Lucretius, ancient atomic physics, but yeah, that suddenly... wrong-footed and left left on your back, flat on your back.
Whether that's dream or memory, actually, because I think memory is probably more your kind of the wind that seems to sort of like blow you.
But I'm also very interested in the unconscious and, yeah, your fabulous typo poem and the sort of mishearings that happen throughout your poems, Isabel. You're interested in the Freudian slip, aren't you, as a sort of portal into the unconscious. And I'm deeply interested in that as well. The provisional title of this new book is Babel's Drift, which I'm slightly nervous about. It might not stay the title, but it's from a poem about genetics and DNA and codes and the crypticness of that, but it's also about the scrambling that happens, the mishearing that needs to happen from generation to generation. I'm so interested in your mishaps of typography as a way of thinking through that necessary swerve if we're going to stay alive and keep moving, keep changing.
Mm. Is psychoanalysis something that is of interest to both of you? I mean, I don't really know that much about it, so I'm always loath to bring it up. So I'm like, here's your thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm nowhere near an expert in it, but yeah, I'm very interested in it. And I think a lot of, I mean, not necessarily through, like on purpose, but I think the Lacanian concept of like the mirror stage and seeing oneself in through projections or from the external world and especially through the mother, like that's definitely something that has run through my work. And you know, you're talking about being a mature woman and still writing about your mother. I have no doubt I'll do that throughout my life as well, because it's such a formative relationship, and if there are unhealthy elements to that relationship, it can take the rest of your life to unlearn them or to figure out how to work with them. And yeah, so much of you does come from how you experience that relationship. So that's just one. I'm also thinking about group psychology, thinking about how we behave when we're around other people versus one-on-one, power dynamics, things like that. It's always fascinating to me how people behave and, yeah, at times which are at odds with how they believe themselves to be.
Which also features in the book, right? The sort of the studies, or I guess the terminology for studies, the horizon effect, the bystander effect. That's another kind of organizing principle of the book, actually, sort of within the larger, more immediate organizing principle. So I don't know whether you wanted to speak to that as well, those sort of subtitles almost.
Yeah. So, I mean, originally they were, some of those were the section titles, but I think Lavinia Greenlaw, you know, very rightly, she was like, you know, everything that the reader has to go through to get to the first poem is like a door. So you've got the cover and the title, and then you've got the epigraph, and then there was a section title, and then there were section epigraphs, and it was a bit too much. And I think, yeah, like you've said earlier, like clarifying the central arc through just stages of life kind of helped with that. So with the effect poems, I started with the Kuleshov effect, which is this concept in cinematic theory that the meaning of an image is derived through its proximity to other images before and or after it. So the like classic example is like was given by Alfred Hitchcock, I think. So like if you see a picture of a man smiling and then you see a baby, you'll think he's smiling at the baby and, oh, what a sweet old man. And then if you see a man smiling and then a young woman in a bikini, you'll think, he's a leering, you know, kind of predatory old man or whatever. And so the meaning changes based on what's around this image. And so similarly, in childhood, so much of who we are is shaped by our environment. So that's where I started with that one. And then the Mpemba effect about water, how water, like the fact that hot water freezes faster than cold water. I heard that and I just wanted to write about that. I didn't know how initially, but I just knew it's a fascinating question of transformation and how things change in unexpected ways. And then I had a few others. And at that point, I realized I wanted to have one per section. So then it was just a case of assigning others to that. And I think these phenomena, which are strange and unexpected, but somehow really fit in our experience of the world and kind of confirm some of the things we understand to be true, they seem to fit with the things I was exploring as well.
It's so nice to have somebody with all that kind of editorial stuff so fresh. Because when people, anyone asks me why I put a poem in a certain place, I'm like, I don't know, like, probably told to, you know, that to have like the sort of, but there is that kind of like, particularly when you don't arrive with a huge like schema and plan in mind, and you're kind of like, it can feel like this is tenuous or rigged up, but then also it's kind of like this makes sense, or, and you arrive to this finished thing. And then of course everyone imagines that that was the plan from the start. So it's good to have a little peek behind the curtain on the Faber podcast. Yeah.
To talk about the editorial process.
Let's
talk. But we have another talisman.
We do. So I wanted to bring the dollhouse that I had when I was a little girl. But that was way too big. So I decided to just bring the staircase. I thought there were different bits I could have brought. And I thought the staircase was pretty cool because it connects different parts of the house. And then I think Jungian psychology, like the basement or the cellar, is like the subconscious. The middle part of the house is the ego, and then the attic is supposed to be the superego. So that kind of relates a lot of what I'm trying to connect and explore, how different parts of ourselves arise in unexpected ways. The reason why I bought something from my dollhouse is that it has a really like strange ambivalent significance for me. So I loved Barbies when I was little, like a lot of girls, but my mother was used to buy me other dolls as well, like porcelain dolls, which I always found quite strange because it's like I couldn't play with it, and whenever I did they would break, and then she would get upset, and I was, you know, I felt bad, but in the back of my mind I was like, why would you give me something I can't play with? And then she also bought me this dollhouse. That was all right. It was I don't remember being particularly enthusiastic about it, but it was fine. Flash forward to like 2023. So we went to visit my grandma, who we hadn't spoken to in almost 20 years. And in her living room, she had the exact same dollhouse as the one I'd had when I was a kid. And it was
not the same one. This is a different one.
Not my dollhouse, but right. the exact same.
That's so toy, uncanny.
Which yeah, it uncanny was. Though. It was, and I couldn't. I was. Yeah, I couldn't even.
Was it hers? How did it? What was the story behind?
So she came to the UK from Jamaica when she was 16. So I doubt it was her dollhouse. It may have been my mother's, but for various reasons, I also kind of feel like that may not have been the story as well. So, yeah, it was just weird, this presence and, yeah, this kind of like connection between our generations. And so we still have mine, but I've gotten rid of almost everything from before 2022. Pretty much everything, like nothing from before that date exists. Mm. But my mother insists on keeping the dollhouse because she says you need to pass it down to your daughter. And so for me, this kind of encapsulates this thing of inherited trauma and the things that families pass down and the cycles that repeat themselves, whether you want them to or not, and what it takes to resist that, because I want to get rid of it and she doesn't want to get rid of it.
Mm. And the way that objects are like so... Like, that's a very real talisman, isn't it? That somebody's, like, the way that people place these stories or histories into objects.
Yeah.
I mean, even to know that you've got rid of everything before a certain date yeah. is kind of evidence of your own kind of projection onto... I mean, that's very Lacanian, isn't it? The object and...
Probably.
Yeah. Also that you've
shedding skin.
The yeah. stairs. You've bought the, yeah. the literal, like, pathway between floors.
Yeah.
What happens when you remove this and abstract this from the doll's house? That's incredible. Mm. It suddenly takes it into the realm of, like, Escher and
yeah.
Piranesi and these endless mazes you can never... escape.
I didn't see it as stairs either. When you had it, I thought it might have been some kind of desk tidy.
Ooh.
Like yeah. outside
oh,
of it.
Cute.
Put your pens on it yeah. to stop them rolling around.
But yeah, have ooh, you removed cute. The pathway or are you like carrying the pathway with you? Because when you were talking about the
question.
Floors, I was like
yeah.
something about taking the
yeah.
the pathway between like floors and histories away or... Mm.
I think the floors between them is very important. Like, I'm all about collapsing the divide between parts of the self and embracing every part, even the parts that we don't like initially, because, like, within reason, you know, I think it's important to be true to our impulses and everything we feel and to live authentically. So, yeah, I'm all about collapsing that divide. But also when it relates to intergenerational things, then that you need to tread carefully and be very mindful of what you're traversing.
Hmm.
Yeah.
The narcissist. I've never been the type for looking in mirrors. I'll check a mole, I shave. I wore contacts in my 20s. I had a girlfriend back there who liked us to pose full length. Better than porn, she said, but I couldn't look, or not for long. It's because of your emptiness within, she whispered. I was the narcissist, and it's true, all my life I've harboured this selfie in my head. One that's blurry and soft focus. It must have been implanted early on by my mother. I mean something cherubic, but essentially featureless. And though it's aged, it has kept its original nullity. Do you, psychoanalysts, have an angle on this? Is it mellifluously dissected in Gallic abstraction? Whenever I'm caught off guard in a hotel or new bedroom, it comes as a shock. I'm in the presence of another male who is florid and badly proportioned, but not repulsive. This morning, in a dream that came when I dozed off between tweets, I found myself high above the diagonal, back with that ex in a natico. My old, old girlfriend, who trained me to love food and sip cognac, to appease lapdogs and night porters, wear shades, relax in a fast car. She'd brought along her props in a little crocodile case. The music was on. Bowie, I think, though the sound was distorted. I could hear her intakes of breath and smell her warm skin. Then I opened my eyes as instructed, or dreamed I did. I understood what I saw in the mirror was my corpse.
So that was The Narcissist by Morris Redden. There's so much that's kind of Morris or Riordan-esque about this poem. The kind of like death and the mortal body. There's the sort of the things like dozed off between tweets. I don't know what. And like the comeuppance of being Flash. The old girlfriend who trained me to love food and sip cognac, which I suppose is all part of the kind of the decadence, like as in decay as well, of this poem. And it's like the horror of it, you know, but not being able to look. The conceit of the poem being that if you don't look at yourself in the mirror or you can't, then you're the real narcissist because you're scared of your body. You're scared of like...
Well, I'm trying to figure out where the real narcissist is because it feels so upfront and so like it's offering itself up into this position. And so not confessional is the right word, but it's like it's an admittance of something that feels so straight up that I'm trying to find the kind of the reality of the narcissism, because all of it is, I mean, the very fact of the poem feels narcissistic because it almost feels sarcastic in a way. I think that's what I'm trying to get to.
Yeah, I mean, what could be more narcissistic in a way than writing a whole poem about your own narcissism? Mm. Really? but I think it's this inversion. It's kind of like, again, there is like the moral of the story, which does, there is often a kind of, not a moral, but a kind of, who the hell do we think we are about Morris's poems? And this is, it's kind of like, oh, I don't like looking at myself in the mirror. Or like to judge someone else for their kind of like enjoying their body. And to say, oh no, I couldn't possibly. Mm. Because actually what you're avoiding is your own mortality. You imagine that you're something that you're not able to look at in the mirror, you know.
But it also feels like, it feels like talking to a nightmare man.
Yeah.
Like the kind of man who's like, I couldn't be a narcissist. I don't care about looking at myself in the mirror. But there's something like more developed happening there.
Mm-hmm.
But there is this kind of weird cruelty to its tone or something. Yeah, Do you sense that?
Yeah, it is.
Like it feels like there's a kind of a performed sort of judgment. I think that's what it is.
I think we'd have to ask Morris about this, but I think there's something really Shakespearean about some of Morris's lyrics.
Mm.
I've never been the type for looking in mirrors. I check a mole, I shave.
Right, yeah.
There's something like the kind of
villainy. Even the girl, it's the girlfriend who trained me to love food, and so I would never, engage in such blah, 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 blah.
There's the kind of preemptive waterproofing of an argument that's then going to be turned on its head. Like, you know,
her props in a little crocodile case. Like, it feels so hilariously.
But I then am not made for sportive tricks.
I'm also thinking about someone like, who's the villain? The Patrick Bateman. It feels like that, kind of.
Yeah. There is that.
The sort of like too precise conception of yourself.
Mm.
The idea that you have a handle on who you are and how you've come to be you, which is narcissism.
Yeah.
Which is narcissism, right?
It outmaneuvers itself and it outmaneuvers...
I mean, that final line is just unreal.
Yeah, it is. Oh, it's a news alert, sorry.
It was the final line. It was like, I know, right? It's so good.
Yeah, Morris Riordan discovers own body in... in mirror. BBC News, other networks are available. Anyway, I think I've harboured this selfie in my head one that's blurry and soft focus. He admits that it's true.
But again, it must have been implanted early on by my mother.
Yeah,
there's this weird offsetting of like, couldn't be a male preoccupation. I just check a mole every now if I have to.
Yeah.
If I'm told to.
I like, there's also like even, the, but again, I think this Shakespearean villainous soliloquizing, glass-willing of language and rhetoric is in there. Things like, do you psychoanalysts have an angle on this? Like the punning kind of, there's another one of those, isn't there? Which one is it? I can't remember.
Well, even mellifluously dissected in Gallic abstraction.
That could be cheated of feature by dissembling nature, you know, from Richard III.
I think that this is sort of what, like, my favourite mode of poem. And I think about Luke Kennard when I think about poets Poets who have an absolute awareness of their capacity for evil and they just go, oh, there you go.
They prize the lid
open. But there's this joy in the kind of, there's a glee in being able to just put an arm in and wriggle it around a bit and then,
I think that is the kind of, I mean, actually, I should say that I've just been I've just been editing a selected of Morris's work, and that kind of reality check on our behalf. There's a really nice, Patrick Kavanagh talks about majority secrets and blabbing, like disclosing something shameful or embarrassing, and how actually that's an enormous relief to everyone that reads it. You think that it's something that you shouldn't do, but actually, and I mean, I talk about this a lot with students as well, that sometimes to disclose something like private and shameful is an enormous kindness to other people who've probably not. And I think the kind of like, what could be like more deliciously kind of difficult to talk about or shameful, you know, than like what you think about your naked body in front of a mirror, and like even if you don't like what you see, what that says about you, and if you like what you see, what that says about you.
I did this kind of double take with it because it almost felt like the beginning of a new poem in which another way of seeing the self was written. I saw what I saw in the mirror was my corpse. I feel like another poem could begin. I understood what I saw in the mirror was my corpse. And then we move away from this self as corpse or self as alive self. It felt like there was some something interesting happening there with how the body, how we choose to perceive the body.
Yeah, well, I mean, it makes me think of like this poem about like how in the Middle Ages or whatever, when we saw our bodies a lot more, and you have those like aristocrats' graves or whatever, or like priests' graves in cathedrals, and they're like literally like their dead bodies, you know, they're like skeletal, laid out, their death mask or whatever, often with like a little rat on them or something. I've seen one.
A little familiar.
Yeah, just to remind you of where you're headed. Mm. Like the dance of death, that notion, which was like very popular, that whether you're the Pope or a pauper, you're all headed in the same direction.
And it's interesting that he sees this in the mirror. The speaker sees this in the mirror.
Yeah.
He doesn't look down at himself.
No. And it's in a mirror in a dream, you know. Yes, or just like in the idea that like when you look at yourself in the mirror, you're shocked to be in the presence of another male. I think that's such a sort of the uncanny, the shock of it. Or a new mirror. Like I often bemoan the fact that there isn't really a mirror at my height. I can never do a fit check, Rachel, because...
You sound like a narcissist.
I do, because I can never see my shoes. If I have to stand close enough or far away, I don't know.
Who can afford a full-length mirror in this economy?
Well, I mean, Hannah, my partner, who's shorter, she can see herself. So whenever I go to, like, a hotel and it's got, like, a full-length mirror, I'm like, oh, my God, do I look like that? You know, like, what an odd-shaped gentleman. You know, I don't know. There's never a mirror that's true. It only reveals what you see. Like,
and they're also haunted, so be careful if you buy another one.
Oh, and the changing rooms.
Just full of the people who have stood before them.
Ah, in H&M on a Tuesday.
Having a little having
a little cheeky vape.
You could write the sort of towards Maurice Riordan's The Narcissist.
I've already written the
poem that made.
I've written the introduction, Rach.
That's it's okay.
Fine.
Yeah, you're not going to write a response poem to this.
God no.
About looking in H&M.
No, I never look in the mirrors. I shun the mirrors as far as I can. And I guess
do you
that...
just check a mole? Do you shave? Did you wear contacts in your 20s?
No, no. I just try and avoid the whole issue of looking like anything. If I could be a brain in a jar, I would be.
That can be arranged.
I think
seriously.
Well, I'd like to be sentient. I'd like to be a good-looking brain
in a nice jar. Cryogenic facilities in the Midwest that can accommodate that request.
You sound like someone who might be working.
Well, who's to know?
Anyway, it's a banger, isn't it? And it's, I think it's really, it's fairly recent, this poem, but I think it's really nice that Morris's new book is coming out and we get to revisit these. The things like the music and the voice of it and the tone of it. I'm really excited about this book coming out and people who don't know his work being introduced to it, and people who do know his work being shocked to rediscover it, actually.
Mm. Well done on all your work on it.
Thanks.
So that was from Maurice Riordan's Selected Poems, which is edited and selected and introduced by Jack Underwood, published by Faber. Maybe now's a good opportunity to hear another poem from you, Isabel.
Yeah, sure. Okay, this is another poem inspired by a dream in which I was sitting with my ex-husband and someone who was asking me his name, and for the life of me, I couldn't remember. This is called Janus. The two of us kept swapping faces. By that point, it was the only thing keeping us together. Buttercups turned when I passed, as though I were you, and not just the face I wore, but also the name it answered to. Why would you give me your name? I can incriminate you with so much less. I have a scab shaped like your foot, the curves of my ear molded to your voice. And I made you too, being for being. Your dreams are the sequels of mine, and the brown of your eyes is the earth I gave you. One morning after a swap, someone asked me your name and I couldn't remember it. But they were staring, and you were staring and smiling at me so sweetly. I started coughing to fill the silence, but I coughed so much that everyone thought I was dying. And now I'm tubed up in a forgotten room with a number for our name and our faces are stuck and no one will touch me. I find a stranger's mirror in your pocket, but I can't bring yourself to look at it. I am scared of what you might see. I'm scared that if I were lost in a crowd, it would still be your face I was looking for.
Amazing, thank you.
And Sarah, can we have another poem from you?
This poem is kind of a tribute to Emnor Beze Philip's discourse on the logic of language. Oh. You know, with that amazing line, so many, but English is a foreign anguish. and also, I guess, the homophonic deformations of Brandon's Somme, where he's thinking about this string of echoes as a figure for sort of immigrant experience down the generations. Undersong 3. No, I do not speak my mother's language. Other tongue, nether tongue, long gone birthright tongue, mutter tongue, untuned, unstrung. Two sang in my child's ear, one sense, the other a koan of tones and underlonging, unbelonging. I do not my unknown language, with age only harder won. My burden tongue, refrain, mend my dead end tongue. I do not own my mother's tongue. I speak alone my father language, loaned tongue, a loaned song, gauge, my ears gauge, hamstrung, my further tongue, falter tongue, I hone and never gone, a knot undone.
Mm. Gorgeous.
Thank you. I was just thinking about sound sense and wordplay and playfulness and ludic permissions, and the fact that you are both involving different areas of thinking, different lexicons, psychologies, memories, histories, performances, places, films, etc. And just the fact that, from what we've heard of your new work today, Sarah, and thinking about your previous work and reading Chaotic Good, this idea of play, language play, mm-hmm. keeps coming up to me as something that maybe you both fall into or take a kind of solace in, even though there is this narrative that is being communicated. There are stories here that are being communicated. Mm. The language play and the fact of the fabric of the language being so enjoyed and the sound sense that comes through from both works feels so strong and hopeful and playful and joyous, actually.
Mm.
And I was thinking about hamstrung tongue sound in that poem.
Yeah.
And then just even thinking about this idea of the kind of the loops of mishearings and mistakes that are so pleasurable in the book. And I guess I'm just thinking a little bit about the texture of language and humour, play.
Mm.
Maybe this, what is conjured through sound and what is conjured through language play,
yeah.
especially how that maybe links to this idea of approaching memory, reapproaching memory, reversioning memory.
Yeah, and also that slightly kind of, I think that when you do sort of cede control to music a bit, that you're also kind of like, you're also sort of like allowing meaning, you're giving yourself a day off from meaning. And there is something kind of simultaneously kind of provocative, self-provocative, and like, dissident about that.
Disobedient.
Yeah, that's a better word. Yeah, kind of a naughtiness.
And as an ownership, when I think about these works, there's like this bit of it is going to be wholly mine, even though there are these histories, difficult histories, contested histories. There's that like, this ownership is mine because I am the language master.
I think one origin story for my adult self as a poet is my having grown up for my first seven years in Hong Kong, hearing ambiently all around me Cantonese, a language I couldn't understand. Mm. So the koan of tones I describe in that poem, and experiencing that language as a sort of deeply familiar and comforting texture, but that one that didn't offer up sense.
Mm.
So I'd listen to my mum speaking on the phone and she'd sort of speak a string of Cantonese, and then she'd suddenly say lunch and I'd know what she was talking about.
And Cantonese is that really sort of swishy quality. Is that, or am I thinking of somebody, I was talking to a friend from Hong Kong the other day and they were talking about the difference between...
I think there's a roundness to it that maybe is different from what I think of the angularity of Mandarin.
Yeah.
Hong Kong Cantonese, this is a class stratified thing to some extent, but does bring in a lot of English smattered around. So it is already a hybrid, a colonial hybrid, that language. But I think there's a pleasure in that unmooring of sound from sense that I think is definitely carried into my practice and my playfulness as a poet. So I've always written poems. There are lots of poems in Loop of Jade that are really only one step away from nonsense. Mm. And I guess I've sort of fought hard to keep that as a part of my lexicon as a poet, that it might be easy to just say, okay, those are experiments that can go in the drawer, but I do feel like they're part of me and part of the face I want to put in the world.
Mm.
I think One Step Away from Nonsense should be the title. That'd be a really fun title. Thinking about wordplay, I think for me, I mean, I'm generally suspicious of the English language particularly. And then language is just, I think it's just so fun and fascinating, like how we relate thoughts and ideas to language and how certain things are kind of impossible to kind of comprehend in a certain language or culture because we don't have the word for that. And also I love puns. Like I said earlier, I love like sound and musicality and how those things can make sense in their own way. So I think I naturally gravitate towards that kind of experimentation.
Mm.
Jack's really good at puns. I feel like we always end up talking about puns.
Yeah, I enjoy a terrible... My brain does kind of auto-pun.
You're really good at pun. I'm not
it just
good at
finds, pun. It finds its way. I was talking to Eleanor Penny recently and found a very, like, yeah, like my sister in puns. And it's funny, we just kind of like... we talk about one step away from nonsense. We're like in the middle
but puns,
of the road of nonsense,
to
just
me,
punning at each
don't
other.
Don't feel like nonsense. I'm interested in the idea of nonsense actually as well, because puns to me feel like sense. I struggle to get to the sense of the pun. I always say something like way off kilter. Like I've told you about this game before that my friend invented, which was a Beatles themed restaurant. So you would have like. Hey, oh, it's called Hey Food, right? That's what the restaurant's called.
Okay.
And then everything in it has to be like Beatles themed, like Penna Lane. I didn't come up with any of these.
Penna Lane. I see. Yeah, yeah, okay, get it. Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And they're just going for it with these things. And I can't even remember any Beatles songs.
You know what's
at that
funny
point.
When you said Beatles, because I was thinking of an actual Beatle. So it took me a minute. So I think that's
it always takes me. I'm probably only just realised what he meant at this stage, but yeah.
So that's the power of puns, like, because I was thinking, this person must be really into bean sex. Like, that's kind of cute.
Yeah, it's like scarabs.
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of the brain. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if it's
I think
just...
some people are good at it and some people aren't. And I am interested in those who are good at it.
My favourite kind of pun is where you're speaking in one language and someone else is hearing in another. Like, I guess this is the Babel fascination coming through. But the first new poet I'm bringing to Chateau, Karen Downs Barton, her book is called Minx. And that was because she used to hear her Romani family speaking about her. So her grandmother used to refer to her as Minx, which is the Anglo-Romani word for a mixed race person. It's pejorative. But Karen was listening in English, so she thought they were calling her a minx, like a little minx, you know. So isn't that great?
That is, yeah. I love that.
I love how like little things in language are so similar but so far apart. Like spoonerisms are really funny. Like, yeah, Eleanor was telling me the other day about this, about the difference between a crusty bus station and a busty crustation.
Yeah. You know, like, that's not an established thing. I don't even know what that means. What's a crusty bus station?
Nothing, but what, a bus station that, yeah, come on, you live in Lewisham.
But then what's a busty crust station?
Well, a busty crustation is like a lobster with breasts.
Oh.
Yeah.
See, this is, I don't...
Or like my favourite...
It's too far for me.
My favourite joke
down.
Of all time is, how do you titillate an ocelot? You oscillate its titilla. Yeah, it's perfect. And these are like, I think that's just like, that's so magical and stupid and brilliant. Like,
well, it's Carolinian. Lewis Carroll. It's like Lewis Carroll,
right?
Yeah. Or Edward Lear.
Cannelloni, delicious.
It's Cannellonian.
Yeah.
It's
Cannellian.
It's Cannellian.
There's something very close between Cannelloni and...
I always say, can I have a Cannelloni?
You're a Cannellonely person, Rachel.
I'm not kind of lonely. I've got loads of mates.
Oh, God, it unravels so quickly.
Like, I think, though, what a wonderful place to end.
Yeah.
We've joyous all got, uplift of pun.
We've all got crusty bus stations to go to. And maybe a busty crust station to go home to. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
So
thank you so much.
For being here, for sharing these extraordinary pieces, poems, books. We're so excited for both of these to be out in 2025. To lead us out of the episode, we will have an audio postcard from Sasha Debevec-McKenney, whose debut collection, Joy Is My Middle Name, is published by Fitzcarraldo Editions.
Hi, my name is Sasha Debevec-McKenney, and I'm reading this poem in my little kitchen in Decatur, Georgia. It's called At 33. At 33, I have no problems touching a stranger's underwear in the laundromat. I don't idle. I recycle. I always dig the caramel ribbon out of the pint of ice cream. I know what's coming for me, which is why I try not to judge my friends for their small bladders. Once a week, someone stops me on the street to say, "You're so pretty." It's not enough. I'm only willing to drive 8 miles over the speed limit. I get a little lonely when I pull my car into the driveway and see my car's not there. My biggest ick is littering. I've only slept with one girl. She looked exactly like me. My body is an optical illusion. My hometown was founded in 1633. I still want a baby. My relationship with alcohol is no more complicated than my relationship with any other substance in the universe. I could go find someone to sleep with at the bar, but I already have that t-shirt. The man who helped me move my dresser out of the estate sale said he could tell by my sweat that my organs were working correctly. I don't want to date anyone whose family came over on the Mayflower ever again. On Sundays, I purchase an expensive decaf latte and go on a 3-hour walk. I want to be taken care of and I need to be kissed. I did a foot peel and peeled all the dead skin off my feet. So if we meet, my feet will feel so smooth and so brand new. Thank you. Bye.
That was the Faber Poetry Podcast, presented by Rachel Allen and Jack Underwood and produced by Hannah Marshall, Jack Underwood and Rachel Allen for Faber and Faber.
You can listen to our podcast on your favourite audio platform. And don't forget to subscribe, rate and tell your friends about our show.